Hello, everyone. It's Ryan, coming to you from the New Books Network, Native American History Channel. We're going to be discussing Thunder in the Mountain by Professor of Law and History at Vanderbilt University, Daniel Sharfstein. Again, Thunder in the Mountains from Daniel Sharfstein. Welcome, Professor Sharfstein.
Thanks for having me on the podcast.
First, let's discuss the cover, okay? You have a pretty striking photograph of Whitebird Canyon, as well as composite photos of Howard and Joseph. Can you tell us more about how the cover was assembled?
When I was at the point where we were discussing the cover, I was asked to provide as many images as possible to give their designers some ideas. Howard, Oliver Otis Howard and Chief Joseph were both photographed many, many times over the course of their lives. I sent a ton of photographs of both of them to the press. And then I also sent a number of photos of the landscape at various points along the Nez Perce Trail. In the course of researching the book, I traveled the entire trail. I took lots and lots of pictures, and I was looking at those pictures at a lot of the time as I was writing the book. And the photos they selected included a picture of General Howard at a relatively young time. So he was in the Civil War when this picture was taken. It was after his arm had been amputated, his right arm, and he was a relatively young man in his 30s. And then they chose a picture of Chief Joseph. It was important to me that they selected a photo of him that was pretty close in time to the Nez Perce War. There are many, many pictures of him photographed towards the very end of his life, almost 30 years later. And they chose a photo from fairly soon after the surrender. The photo they chose that I took of the landscape was a picture from Whitebird Canyon, which was the site of the first battle in the Nez Perce War. And Whitebird Canyon is accessible from the pretty close to the top of the canyon off the main road, and there's kind of a scenic overlook, and you can see the whole canyon as it ripples down towards Whitebird Creek and the Salmon River. But there's another entrance at the very bottom of the canyon. It's very unassuming, and there's luckily a really nice guide and self-guided walking tour. And so I was walking in Whitebird Canyon in the summer of 2013. And this was a photo from a point where I'm looking towards Whitebird Creek and the Salmon River. It would be the direction that the U.S. Army would have been facing. It was from a place where really the first shots in the war were fired.
So let's start exploring a little bit of the book and your approach to the study. How did you approach the history of the 1877 Nez Perce War? How did you approach narrating, framing, researching the 1877 Nez Perce War? Does your title, which is, again, Thunder in the Mountains, Chief Joseph Oliver Otis Howard and the Nez Perce War, does Thunder in the Mountains refer to Joseph's Nez Perce or Nimiput name, Thunder Rolling in the Mountains, or something more? So, again, how did you approach the study, and can you elaborate a little bit more on the title?
So I'll say about the title, Thunder in the Mountains definitely is a reference to Chief Joseph's name. And even though this was in many ways a dual biography, it's a story of Oliver Otis Howard and Chief Joseph, I've always thought of Chief Joseph as the heart of the story. I think I also viewed the war as really the heart of the story. And the Chief Joseph's name, and also the descriptions of the war, which was fought in very mountainous terrain. People would describe it with all kinds of naturalistic metaphors. You know, people would say that these battles, it was like a hailstorm, or and people described the tolling of guns and of cannons as thunder. So I felt like it was a good way to signal the primacy of Chief Joseph's place in this story, and also to think about the war and the importance of the setting of this war. In terms of my approach to the history of the war, I think that there are two things that I particularly focused on. There have been many wonderful histories of the Nez Perce War, and people have been writing about it really from the time it happened. And in many ways, I mean, just decade after decade over the past 140 years, the fascination with the Nez Perce War and the desire of so many people, whether they're in academia or out, to write about it and talk about it and remember it, remains very, very strong. What I wanted to do, first of all, was bring in Oliver Otis Howard's perspective in a more robust way. So for me, the Nez Perce War has been something that I've thought about, has been sort of part of my consciousness really from the time I started to read. One of the first books I ever read was a child's biography of Chief Joseph that my mother gave to me. It was part of a series of lives of great Americans, and you know, it was George Washington and George Washington Carver and Helen Keller and Chief Joseph, among others. And but what really drew me into the story was the connection to Oliver Otis Howard. So my first book was in many ways a history of Reconstruction and its aftermath, and the nation's transition from slavery to freedom and then to Jim Crow. And Oliver Otis Howard was an important character in this, by virtue of his leadership of the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands, the Freedmen's Bureau. And in the course of researching the earlier book, I found a series of letters to Howard that were written in the heyday of Reconstruction, with one of the main figures in my book. And then there was this 10-year gap, and in 1878, there's a letter addressed to Howard in Portland, Oregon, saying, what's life like in the West? Do you think that Washington Territory would be a good place to relocate freed people from the South? And I read that and I thought, wow, you know, what's Howard doing in Portland? He was a Maine Yankee. He was a consummate Washington figure during Reconstruction. And Portland, Oregon, was about as far as you could get from Washington, D.C. and still be in the continental U.S. And then in the back of my mind, I thought, when was the Nez Perce War? And when I realized that Howard had led army forces against the Nez Perce families, it seemed like a very important story to revisit, because I'd always thought of the Nez Perce War as a war that the U.S. waged against people who were led by a great civil rights icon, Chief Joseph, And understanding that it was Howard who led the army forces, really, this is a war that one civil rights icon, Oliver Otis Howard, the namesake for Howard University, led against another civil rights icon. And to me, that spoke volumes about the pivot that America was making away from Reconstruction at the end of the 19th century. So Howard's perspective, understanding how he could go from championing African-American civil rights to waging war against Nez Perce families, that seemed very important to me. You know, if you read Southern histories, Howard comes off as a flawed person, to be sure. But I think I would define him pretty firmly as a flawed hero. He was William McFeely's phrasing, he was the Yankee stepfather. He had all kinds of limitations of imagination and administrative ability. But he was remarkably committed to the enterprise of African-American freedom and equality. That's the perspective in Southern history. If you read Western history, Howard comes off very, very differently. As a comically inept general, as a scourge of the Nez Perce people. And reconciling the two General Howards, that was a big impetus for my work. The second approach that I brought to the book was really focusing on Joseph's work as an advocate. So in the 5 years before the Nez Perce War, from about 1872 to 1877, but from the time when settlers really started coming into the Wallowa Valley, Joseph had countless occasions to advocate. And I mean, in certain ways, very early on when he decided to knock on the doors of settlers' cabins and lean-tos and introduce himself and inform them that they were trespassing on his people's land. He was informed that under a treaty signed in 1863, the Wallowa Valley had been ceded to the United States. It had been put into the public domain. It had been surveyed and divided up, and the homesteads were being given away. So 1872, in many ways, that feels like it could be the end of a story. But once the government has given away something, once they've given away the land, it's really hard to take that land back. And instead of regarding this as an ending, I was very intrigued by the way that Joseph took this as a beginning. He faced daunting challenges. He was a young man. He in the world that, the constellation of Nez Perce leaders, it's a remarkably egalitarian and broad-based structure of governing. He was relatively low on the hierarchy. There were many other leaders of other bands who had much more seniority, much more experience as fighters, much more experience hunting in the plains to the east of the Bitterroot Mountains. But Joseph really took it upon himself to try and reach out to the federal government and explain why his land had been mistakenly and unjustly taken away from his people. And that's really tough when you're in the Wallowa Valley, a couple thousand miles away from Washington, surrounded by mountains that were so steep that when the settlers came in, they had to take apart their wagons, haul them up the mountain, reassemble their wagons, and then coast into the valley. So figuring out who to talk to, figuring out how to get your words to leave the valley and connect to the nodes of power, this was certainly the cause of Joseph's life in the 5 years before the war. His experience connecting with and negotiating with the federal government colored his experience of the war. And then, you know, at the end of the war, he uttered his famous surrender statement. He said, "I will fight no more forever." But in many ways, he kept fighting. He kept trying to reach out and negotiate with the federal government, and he was constantly trying to advocate for a better deal for his people. And you know, thinking about how he was able to do that, to me, it said a lot about the structure of American power and the way it was very, very diffuse in the decades after the Civil War, right as the administrative state is emerging. In certain ways, Chief Joseph his message can feel very modern. The way he talked about rights, the way he talked about the kinds of freedom and the kind of equality that every American should expect. His conception of citizenship that, I think initially began as a conception of Nez Perce sovereignty, but then it kind of moves into citizenship and rights. But at the same time that his message was modern, his methods were also. He's making a plea for citizenship, for liberty, and for equality in an age of big government.
Let's talk a little bit about Howard. So following the 1873 failure of the Freedmen's Bank and an acquittal in the Freedmen's Bureau inquiry, Howard negotiated with several Southwest Native communities and then became head, as you've already alluded to, of the Department of the Columbia River in Oregon Territory. How and why did evangelicalism and this new post contribute to Howard's conception of freedom? From the sole fear that government aid might foster dependency to the growing concern that the absence of government might actually in turn, and the absence of government assistance may also foster a form of dependency. How did Howard, in a related fashion, conceive of the Nez Perce in the context of citizenship and equal protection? So Howard's conception of freedom, how it changed, and then his conception of the Nez Perce in the context of citizenship and equal protection?
These are great questions. So Howard was someone who, he was a Maine Yankee. He was a teetotaler from the beginning. And he graduated from West Point in the mid-1850s and was immediately sent to what he thought of as the worst, most remote posting imaginable, Tampa, Florida. He described Tampa as a field for self-denial. And while he was in Tampa, while he was trying to find Seminoles in the Everglades unsuccessfully, he would go through the Everglades and not see a soul. While he was surrounded by people who were, just dropping from the, and you name the fever. While he was battling depression, being separated from his wife and baby boy by 1,000 miles, that's when God reached out and touched him. That's when God really spoke to him. And he had this sense that, God had reached out to him for a reason. That he was placed on earth for a reason. And then he was just trying to figure out what it was. And when the Civil War was beginning, it began right as he was thinking about leaving the army, going to seminary, and pursuing the ministry. But the war, it seemed like that was a path that was revealing itself. He thought the cause of union, must be why God had singled him out. And very early on, he was promoted to brigadier general without having been in battle at all. And it seemed like this was right. But then he started to revise his conception of his religious and moral purpose. And what really affected him deeply was the fact that when he was commanding troops in Northern Virginia, there was this constant stream of people who were crossing Union Army lines in pursuit of freedom. He spoke to many of them. He had this dramatic encounter where a woman and her baby came across Union Army lines and was pursued by a woman who demanded her property back. And that's when he realized he hadn't been a particularly political in terms of abolitionism. But that's when he realized that the abolition of slavery, that the cause of freedom would be, it was really his purpose. Very early on, he thought that African-Americans should be armed and should be fighting in the Union Army. He was very impressed by the people who came across Union Army lines, their ingenuity in their escapes. And he was convinced that not only should they be free, but that they were equal. Now, he had a very limited sense of what the Freedmen's Bureau could do. I mean, to a certain extent, he couldn't imagine beyond the basic Republican Party talking points about the links between government aid and dependency, the sense that the Freedmen's Bureau would have to be very limited and very temporary in its scope. But at the same time, he remained remarkably committed to a very unitary sense of equality. He wasn't someone who, unlike other abolitionists, was slicing and dicing equality into political equality and social equality. Rather, he viewed African Americans as equal and fully capable of every privilege of citizenship. And to his mind, in the absence of much government help, he would pursue policies that would allow African Americans a fighting chance to leverage themselves into a position of meaningful equality. So first off, he was deeply committed to education and funding education, funneled a lot of Freedmen's Bureau money into education at all levels. And when when a group of influential evangelicals proposed opening a school to train preachers in Washington, D.C., who came out of the freed people, Howard really spearheaded the effort to broaden the scope of that educational institution, to reconceive of it as a full university with a college and a normal school to train teachers and a law school and a medical school. It was almost a given by the time Congress chartered the institution that it would be named after him. He funneled a lot of money towards Howard University, but he also had this vision of equality and how to achieve it when maybe the government wasn't quite up to the task of being particularly supportive of that. The other mode of leverage into equality, at least in the earliest days of the Freedmen's Bureau, was through the potential redistribution of hundreds of thousands of acres of confiscated rebel land. And Howard tried to do that and tried to essentially root African American equality in property ownership, as small freeholders, they would be able to be independent of their former masters. They'd be able to support themselves. They wouldn't be the victims of the markets for employment and for international cash crops. But President Johnson rescinded that order, and Howard didn't have the imagination not to be a good soldier and go along with it. He was someone who, when he realized that he wouldn't be able to redistribute the land, that the land would go back to the former title owners, he thought, well, I can help do the next best thing, and no one who would replace me, I could resign, but no one who would replace me would be as sympathetic as I am to the freedmen. Now, moving west, in many ways, Grant's peace policy enacted a fantasy of Reconstruction for Howard. Howard had been thwarted in many ways. He had been initially denied the ability to redistribute the rebel land. So African-American equality instead was rooted in their property rights and their contract rights, and they would essentially be established as a landless hireling class. But in the West, he had the ability to put Native Americans onto reservations and establish them all as small yeoman farmers. To the extent that he felt thwarted in the provision of government services for the freed people, he had the ability to coordinate all kinds of services for the Native Americans. And in his mind, he was able to pursue a path of peaceful resettlement onto reservations, essentially, we would say forcing people onto reservations. But in his mind, the alternative was genocidal warfare. So he thought of himself as really being on the side of the angels. And he thought that once Native Americans were firmly established as farmers, that they would have full access to the rights of citizenship and had a full claim to equality as citizens. But as we know, once he got out to the West, his theory about what the peace policy could do and his fantasy of it met a harsh reality.
So in terms of Joseph's Nez Perce Band, you've alluded to this earlier. How did they promote an idea of heterogeneous equal protection and citizenship that included polyamorous relations and multiple avenues for band membership? Yet how did their same petitions from the Nez Perce Band demonstrate what you describe as the wilderness of American power? So can you discuss their petitions leading up to the war really briefly?
In the 5 years leading up to the war, Chief Joseph basically tried to find any federal official he could possibly find. And what he was saying to them was that his people had signed an 1855 treaty that guaranteed them the Wallowa Valley, but that the 1863 treaty that ceded the Wallowa Valley had only been signed by bands of Nez Perces who were 100 miles away in Idaho. Wallowa Valley was in the far northeastern corner of Oregon. And he would say that Nez Perce bands were autonomous bands. They were spread out over a large geographical distance, basically from the Wallowa Valley in Oregon all the way to the Bitterroot Mountains, separating Idaho from Montana. And, they were autonomous, and the bands that signed the 1863 treaty not only were they separated from his people by mountains, by a canyon, Hell's Canyon, which is deeper than the Grand Canyon, but they were also Christian converts. So they just lived very, very different kinds of lives. He said they couldn't possibly represent his people. So the pleas of his band were a plea that their representation at that treaty council was necessary for it to bind them.
How and why did the fall 1876 killing of Will Hautia, an Nez Perce man accused of pilfering settler horses, as well as reprisal raids by Juarites, precipitate the Nez Perce War?
For several years in the mid-1870s, the settlers were and in the Wallowa Valley and in the Grand Ronde Valley, just to the west of the Wallowa Valley, they were in certain ways, beating their own drums of war, saying that it was impossible for settlers and Indians to coexist. They were calling in the cavalry, and there was a sense that that war was inevitable. But when the cavalry came in 1874 and then 1875, what they found was Joseph didn't look at them as enemies or potential combatants. He thought of them as just another set of federal officials he could negotiate with. So he had met with the Indian agent, the civilian Indian agent. He'd met with supervisors of Indian affairs for Oregon. Joseph had met with a congressman who was home from recess. And then he saw these army officers, and he viewed them just as another path, another voice that could bring his words to Washington, D.C. And they talked to him, and the reports came out of these cavalry officers saying that Joseph was committed to peace, that he was more reasonable than the settlers. At least one officer, Stephen Whipple, who was writing these reports, he was not programmed to really sympathize with Joseph or with any Native American. He had cut his teeth in the 1860s massacring Native Americans in Northern California. But he spoke to Joseph, he listened to Joseph, and he said, "I think Joseph is right about his legal point with the 1863 treaty, and he's also very reasonable. And I think a lot of the cavalry officers and the soldiers were just relieved to, they were prepared for war, they were frightened, people were deserting on their way into the Wallowa Valley, but they encounter Joseph and they realize that here was a partner for enduring peace." Now, that began to change in the fall of 1876 when there was a confrontation in the Wallowa Valley where a settler wound up killing a young Nez Perce man. At the time, it was thought that there would be all kinds of bloodshed that would flow from the killing of Will Hautia. But again, soldiers came in, and there were more negotiations, and it seemed like while the government had been pushing Joseph to relocate to the reservation and was saying that the 1863 treaty absolutely applied, the result of the negotiations in 1876 seemed to be a reopening of the case. Oliver Otis Howard actually had heard the reports and went east to Washington, and he proposed to reopen negotiations and to finally resolve the Wallowa Valley problem, which in the wake of Custer's Last Stand, the Battle of Little Bighorn, he identified the Wallowa Valley as the next flashpoint for a big Indian war. And to a certain degree, Howard's move, it promoted, it was a mode of self-promotion, and it allowed him to address certain issues head-on that he had been really raked through the coals over during Reconstruction. A lot of people would make fun of his abilities as a general during the Civil War. He was called "Uh-oh Howard" instead of "Oh-oh Howard," but he was able to advocate for himself in Washington, D.C. that not only was this going to be a big war, but he was uniquely qualified as someone who had a pretty good track record of convincing Native Americans to move on to reservations, that he was the man for this job. Also, he had been faulted in many ways for fiscal impropriety during Reconstruction with the Freedmen's Bureau, and newspapers, Republican and Democratic, reported that by reopening this situation and renegotiating and resolving the Wallowa dispute, he could save the government tens of millions of dollars that otherwise would be spent in a war. Now, he went back to the Northwest. He had assembled a committee that was empowered to negotiate the final status of the Wallowa Valley. So essentially, Joseph felt he had succeeded in kind of reopening this situation. But when Howard got to the Northwest and was face-to-face with Joseph, Howard said, we are not going to let you keep the land. What we really are here to do is negotiate a good price for the Wallowa Valley. You're still going to have to go to the reservation. And, if Howard had been able to succeed in getting Joseph to sign on the dotted line, in many ways, he kind of viewed this as a moment of grand redemption for everything he was faulted for during Reconstruction. And with that in his grasp, Joseph said, no, we're not going to accept your terms. We're not going to move to a reservation. We're not here to sell the land where our forefathers are buried. Howard reacted very negatively to this. What he said was, well, if you persist in this, you can't complain if evil happens to you. And he went, reported back east, and the final plans for forcing Joseph's band onto the reservation took shape. That spring in 1877, Howard gathered all the bands that were resisting moving onto the reservation. He presented his position as a fait accompli. He demanded that the bands that were resisting the reservation move onto the reservation in 30 days, which, given their enormous herds of horses and cattle, and also given the state of the rivers that they had to cross, they were all at flood stage. This was a really difficult demand. And when a leader of another band complained, Howard had him jailed. And so there was this ultimatum that Howard had issued, There was this very aggressive posture that he had assumed against people who had always been peaceful with the United States and had always found a way to negotiate their way around difficulty. And Joseph made the trip with his band across the Snake River, across the Salmon River. They lost hundreds of head of horses and cattle, but no one drowned, at least. But by the time they reached the border of the reservation in June 1877, people were demoralized. They were despairing. They were very angry. And it seemed like they were going to enter the reservation, but in a blink, that ended when a group of young warriors decided to go on a revenge killing spree against people in the Salmon River Valley who had been abusive, who had murdered Nez Perce people, who had cheated them in stores. And that put the U.S. on a war footing, and it seemed there was no turning back from that.
Can you discuss the inaugural battle at White Bird Canyon, which is the subject of your photo on your cover? So the inaugural battle at White Bird Canyon, as well as how the war came to an end at Snake Creek. And then in this context, can you also briefly discuss the Nez Perce reburials, as well as the trade and material culture after the battles, in which General Howard would amass a large collection of Indian artifacts. So the White Bird Canyon battle, how the war came to an end, and then touch upon the trade and material culture and the reburials.
After the initial killing spree along the Salmon River Valley, the Nez Perce bands that had gathered to move onto the reservation, instead they moved away. They moved to a traditional campground near the Clearwater River. They moved then to another place, which was a cave where they stayed. And then finally they moved to the bottom of White Bird Canyon at a traditional campsite that was reasonably well protected. But while they were moving around, whenever they encountered, there were warriors and war parties out that were fighting and killing settlers in an area called the Camas Prairie, in Idaho. And the army Howard was waiting at Fort Lapway on the Nez Perce Reservation, expecting Joseph and his band and the other bands to settle. But when word came about these killings in the Salmon River, he sent word to gather troops from the entire Department of the Columbia and beyond, and while he was coordinating the arrival of troops and supplies for a major military expedition, he sent out a couple of cavalry companies to try and relieve the settlers who had holed up for their protection in a town called Mount Idaho. When they got to Grangeville, Mount Idaho, settlers saw the army and said, "We know where the Nez Perce bands have gone, and you've got to get them now. They're at the bottom of White Bird Canyon, and what they might do is cross the Salmon River, maybe even cross the Snake River and head back into the Lala Valley. If you let them get across the rivers now, it's going to be much harder to catch them later." So the settlers really pushed the army to try and confront them in White Bird Canyon. Now, the army, to get to the settlers, cavalry had ridden all night long. The soldiers were exhausted. The horses were exhausted. But then they kept going. For another night, essentially made their way to White Bird Canyon. And in the early hours of the morning, June 1877, they made their way down the steep paths of White Bird Canyon towards the bottom. And at daybreak, a Nez Perce peace party approached the cavalry companies that were also supplemented by many settlers, and they approached with a white flag in an attempt to negotiate a peace before war broke out. But the settlers started shooting, and then the army started shooting. And at that point, a couple things seemed to become clear. One, the cavalry they couldn't hit the side of a barn with a bullet. They had very little training with firearms. The army was reluctant to have any training with firearms because it was just a waste of bullets. So they didn't know how to shoot. They were highly undisciplined. They depended on buglers and to transmit signals from the officers to the men. And early in the battle, the Nez Perce warriors, at least the ones who, very few actually were able to mobilize and fight on short notice early in the morning. Many of them had been drinking, before the battle. But the ones who were awake were able to kill the buglers very quickly. And then no one had any way to communicate with each other. Very quickly, the Nez Perce warriors had flanked the army. The settlers who were guarding the flank just ran away so quickly that the Nez Perce warriors wondered if they were real, if there had ever been anybody on the flank. And then the army soldiers panicked and had to retreat. And what they realized was, they had come down the steep canyon, and now in retreat, they actually had to run uphill, very steep. And it was really hard to do. And the Nez Perce warriors, who go up and down mountains and canyons, had much more experience with that terrain. It was much easier for them to go uphill. And it was much easier for them, even with much worse weaponry, to kill dozens of soldiers. And at the end of that, it seemed about a third of the cavalry had been killed, and the rest kind of found their way to the Camas Prairie. And it seemed after that, it was going to be total war. It also meant that the Nez Perce warriors had a cache of weapons and ammunition that they didn't have at the beginning of the battle. And it was a lesson for Howard that bold army action might not actually win the day immediately, especially in this terrain. Now, flashing forward from June 1877 to the very end of September, very beginning of October 1877, the final battle was at Snake Creek, just north of the Bear Paw Mountains in Montana, about 30-40 miles south of the Medicine Line, the Canadian border. And by that point, the Nez Perce families had been outrunning the army, had been consistently ahead of them for most of 3.5 months. They referred to General Howard as he was not only cut arm, but he was also general day after tomorrow, because he was so far behind them. And they had pursued a very quick path through the Buffalo Plains of Montana. But towards the end, there was a leadership switch, and Chief Looking Glass, who had taken over the tactical side of the Nez Perce bands, had wanted them to slow down. And so they were slowly making their way to the Canadian border. I think in large part, they still had this herd, and the herd was looking ragged and fatigued. And so this was a way to strengthen their herd before they embarked on this new life in Canada, so they could start in a position of wealth and strength. They finally found some buffalo, so they had a chance to hunt some buffalo, which also meant wealth, but also sustenance. And so they had slowed down. They knew that Howard was way behind them, really hopelessly behind them, but they didn't know that Howard had sent a message to Nelson Miles, who was the commander of the garrison at the Tongue River cantonment. And Miles and his cavalry raced towards the Canadian border in hopes of intercepting the Nez Perce bands. And at Snake Creek, they surrounded them. In previous battles, there were moments when the army had surprised them, when they weren't expecting troops from other garrisons to come in. But the Nez Perces had always been able to hold on to their horses. And as long as they had their horse herd with them, they had the means and capacity to escape. But at Snake Creek, at the Bear's Paw, their herds were stampeded, and they were surrounded and besieged. It was possible for many of the Nez Perces to escape. It was a siege, but it was, it's still possible to cross the siege lines and make your way to Canada. But for many of the children, for the elderly, for the many people who were sick or wounded and suffering after 3.5 months of flight, it was impossible for them to flee. The warriors were very well dug in to the hills that rose from this creek. It was a series of folded, the landscape was very folded, and it was very easy to dig in. And so they were able to fight the cavalry to a standstill, to a stalemate. And there was some hope that that Sitting Bull up in Canada would hear from the Nez Perces who had escaped and would send Lakota warriors down and lift the siege. But that never happened. In the meantime, numerous great chiefs, Tohozo, Lean Elk, Looking Glass, Olicott, Joseph's brother, were killed in the battle. And in the end, really, even though Joseph was someone who was not a war chief, had relatively less status among the leadership of the Nez Perce bands, he really was the last leader left who could negotiate. And negotiation was really his forte. And so he sought terms with Nelson Miles and with General Howard, who had arrived on the scene, and received an assurance that after the winter was over, he and his people would be allowed to resettle on the Nez Perce Reservation. After they had surrendered, General Sherman essentially reversed that assurance, reversed that promise, and backed away from that promise. And instead, they were jailed for the winter at Fort Leavenworth, and then sent into exile in Indian Territory in what's now Oklahoma.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the trade in material culture after the battles, in which Howard amassed a large collection of artifacts?
There were battles where Nez Perce families were on the run. There were many things that they couldn't take with them. And at various points, they would dig caches and put these objects that they couldn't carry with them in these caches and bury them. And in a way, it reflected, you know, a certain desperation, but also a certain optimism that they would come back. And after the battles, particularly a battle in Nez Perce country along the Clearwater River, right where it meets Cottonwood Creek, the army came through and they found these caches and uprooted them. And when they unburied them, they found evidence of something that Howard really didn't understand in his negotiations with Joseph to try and establish them as small yeoman farmers. Howard really didn't understand the reality of Nez Perce wealth. And what they found were silver and china place settings that dated back to the fur trade with the Hudson Bay Company. They found these spectacular beaded horse bridles and beaded garments. And there was just incredible evidence of the fact that Joseph Spann's traditional life as herders was really lucrative, that they were wealthy, that moving to the reservation, that giving up their traditional way of life, was an incredible step down. Now, people had often commented on the high quality of Nez Perce beadwork, but there was no real trade in Nez Perce artifacts while all of these items were items that people used in ritual in everyday life. But when the soldiers dug them up, there was an immediate market for these artifacts. If suddenly these weren't vital cultural items, they were collectibles. And the soldiers collected. There was an army surgeon who was known for paying top dollar for Nez Perce artifacts at that point in the war. And there was a sense, not only were they beautiful and divorced from context, they could be decorative objects for white people, but the very fact that these were essentially unburied, the very fact that the Nez Perces were being driven from the land and were essentially being wiped out, this only made them more desirable, more valuable, more romantic. Now, General Howard, over the course of his life, did amass a large collection of Indian artifacts. This was something that I discovered when I was searching online, and I came to the website for an auction house that was auctioning off things in General Howard's collection. But I noticed that there weren't Nez Perce artifacts in those lots that were being sold to the highest bidder. So it's unclear to me whether Howard personally collected and profited from the Nez Perce War, or whether he just developed over the course of his career a taste for Indian collectibles.
appreciate the clarification. So for our final question, I wanted to go into a little bit on the post-war memory. So why do you think Joseph, at the 1904 Carlisle Indian School graduation, why did he ultimately defer, or do you argue that, defer to Howard's speech and his sort of narration of the memory of the war? Why did Joseph capitulate at that 1904 Carlisle Indian School graduation, which they both attended? And then also, can you touch a little bit on Charles Scott Erskine Wood, lest we forget him, a colorful character from your book? How did the memory of the war figure into his 1900 anarcho-democratic, I say democratic, but then he did not really like being called democratic, his critique of U.S. imperialism and imperial markets? And Wood, it was the son of a former cotton farmer. Why can you touch on how the memory of the war affected Wood as well?
So in 1904, 27 years after the Nez Perce War, and really just months before Joseph's death, Joseph and Howard were both sitting on the dais as honored guests at the Carlisle Indian School for graduation exercises. You know, with them was Richard Henry Pratt. It was his last graduation as headmaster of the Carlisle Indian School. And for Joseph, I mean, in many ways, it must have been just a tragic and horrifying sight, you know, to see Nez Perce children and children of many other nations with their heads shaved, dressed in military uniforms, doing military exercises, speaking in English. They were punished if they spoke their native languages, and essentially embodying Richard Henry Pratt's call to kill the Indian and save the man. This was his nightmare. It was why he had fought the Nez Perce War, and at the same time, when Howard gave a speech that seemed to be begging for forgiveness and absolution from Joseph, I think it's really the closest Howard ever came to really admitting that he was wrong. There are other ways he seemed to show his guilt. He could never stop writing about the Nez Perce War, for example. But Joseph stood up, and he didn't do his talking in English. He was maybe one of the few Native Americans to be able to speak their language and not be punished at the Carlisle Indian School. But Joseph looked Howard in the eye and said, "I forgive you." And, that was really puzzling to me. What was going on? Had Joseph just given up? And to me, I found a little traction on this issue when I was reading letters that Howard and Pratt had written in the immediate aftermath of the graduation ceremony, where he forgives them, and then in their letters, they almost immediately afterwards, they're advocating for much more money to be channeled to Joseph's band that at that point was 20 years out of exile from the Indian Territory, but was still in exile in the Northwest on the Colville Indian Reservation. And it seemed that Joseph, you can really see how he never stopped advocating, never stopped, in a very pragmatic way, trying to get the best deal that he could get at any given moment for his people. And I see that final absolution that he seems to give to Howard less as a surrender and more as a moment of opportunity that he sees to try and get resources for his people so they could live their lives. With respect to Charles Erskine Scott Wood, Erskine Wood was a man who was West Point class of 1874, which meant he was too young to really understand the politics, the stakes of the Civil War. And at West Point, if you're there from 1870 to 1874, there was this palpable sense that you had missed the big one. And there was a real sense that it was unclear what purpose serving in the Army served. For Wood, you know, he was kind of a tabula rasa in terms of his politics. He really liked West Point, not because of any noble idea of serving his country, but because he thought they gave, you know, really great waltzes. He loved to waltz above anything else. And when the war began, he had been serving in the Northwest. He had befriended Oliver Otis Howard, and he had the war. He found himself being put on Howard's staff, and he found a purpose in his life that he had always been kind of aimless, even after West Point in the Army, just trying to figure out what to do. But, you know, he went through the war. It was the most exciting experience in his life up to that point. And then he met Joseph at the surrender. And in the 24 hours that followed, he was Joseph's minder. And they spent much of that time talking. And it opened his eyes, you know, it awakened him to something that he had never felt before. And within a few years, he had washed out of the Army. And he had hung out a shingle and started practicing law in Portland, Oregon. And then very early on, he found great success as a lawyer, and it would give him all kinds of financial stability. But at the same time, his politics moved farther and farther to the left. And he was doing a lot of thinking about the Nez Perce War, about the country's broken promises to Joseph and his people. And right at that time, the U.S. Had promised independence to Filipino freedom fighters if they allied with the U.S. during the Spanish-American War. And then they rescinded that promise and seized the Philippines as an American territory. Wood, he was appalled by the U.S. conduct of the Spanish-American War, and there were many Democrats who were critical of this Republican War and particularly the imperial adventure in the Philippines. But many of them were racist Southerners who didn't want an American territory that was full of another dark-skinned race. And Wood, when he took to the stump through Oregon in 1900, railing against the American imperialism, sometimes he would try out those racist Democratic lines. But at the same time, he began thinking about what equality meant. And you know, if Oliver Otis Howard, his early mentor and role model, really thought of equality in terms of the ability to assimilate to, you know, a singular view of American citizenship. For Wood, he developed a sense of equality as a much more pluralistic concept, that there are many ways to be different and still equal. The way he put it was, if all men are equal, then everyone has a right to go to hell if they want to. You know, they can live traditional lives. They can worship different gods, and he declared himself an anarchist. He then became allied with just about every progressive movement of the early 20th century. And he's a real gift to the historian because he lives forever. You know, he's someone who, when he was 8 years old, saw President Lincoln on his way to his first inaugural address, 1861. And when he was 90 years old in 1942, he showed up at the San Francisco headquarters of the Immigration and Naturalization Service and demanded that they release his friend who was being held as a Japanese enemy alien. And he then wrote a letter protesting the internment of Japanese Americans. And between the 1860 and 1942, it's a remarkable journey through, and it really shows the bridge that of the Nez Perce War between the Civil War and Reconstruction, and then the causes and concerns of the 20th century. And as Wood made this remarkable evolution, he again and again came back to his time with Chief Joseph. They met after the war. He sent his son to live with Chief Joseph over two summers in 1892 and 1893. And throughout his life, Chief Joseph was his guiding light. And you see how Joseph is this really important figure who really worked his way into the DNA of the modern American left.
Well, I thank you for being on our podcast today, Professor Sharfstein. Is there anything that we can expect from you next that you can disclose at this time, or do you plan on taking a vacation, or what's next for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. Both of my books, my first book was really about race and the color line, the invisible line. This book is about Western conquest and citizenship and liberty and equality. And to a large degree, they're about what values make us American. How do we define ourselves as an American, and how law works its way into our identity as Americans. And I thought for a third book, I would want to focus on immigration and assimilation. And I'm now doing some research into immigrant communities and their conflicts with each other in the early 20th century. At this point, it's still very much in its early stages. But it's so far been a very exciting new way to explore this enduring theme.
I'm sure our listeners will be looking out for that. Again, thank you for being on the podcast. This is Ryan Tripp on behalf of the New Books Network, the Native American Studies and History Channel, signing off. I'll see you next time.